Shalom Hadavarniks. Welcome to the Hadavar Messianic Ministry School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're in the Jewish Life of the Messiah, the 2021 edition. We're at Lesson 1, Session 3. So let's review where we were in Session 2 as we get started on our new class. In Session number 2, we were introduced to a very important biblical concept, and that biblical concept is the Word of God. It's found in John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word. Now, the Greek text underlying that translation word is the Greek word logos. Now, because it's a Greek word underlying the term word, translating into the term word, many commentators then think that what John is trying to say about Jesus is based on Greek philosophy. Because the logos, Greek philosophers stated, was concerned with reason and speech, they say that what John is trying to say about Jesus is that Jesus was the very idea of God, the idea of reason, and he was the very expression of God, the idea of speech. Now, that's all very nice and good. Jesus is the very idea of God, and he is the very expression of God. But I find this position lacking. It's a very weak position. And why is this position weak? Well, first of all, we're going to the improper source for answers to the question, who is Jesus? We don't go to Greek philosophers to find out who Jesus was. We don't go to historians. We go to the Bible. So going to Greek philosophy is the improper source for answers. Secondly, this position undermines Jewish outreach. Why? Because the Jewish community considers the Gospel of John and the Gospels Gentile books. It's all about their Gentile God, Jesus. Stay away from the Gentile book, the New Testament. And so when you explain that this term is a Greek philosophical term, that just underscores the argument that the Gospels are a Gentile book. And so this undermines Jewish outreach. Finally, shallow thinking is involved. Something's been forgotten. John is not a Greek philosopher. John is a Jewish fisherman. So what did the Word of God and the rabbis teach about the Word of God? We'll take a look at the rabbinic theology, at the Bible, and we'll compare it to the Gospel of John, or we did last week. So the first thing that the Bible and rabbinic theology taught was that the Word was the same as God, yet distinct from God. John agrees, John chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Secondly, the Bible and the rabbis taught that the Word of God was the agent of creation. John agrees. John chapter 1, verse 3 and verse 10. Third, the Word was a person. And that's exactly what the Gospel of John says in verse 3. Fourth, the Word was the agent of salvation. And John agrees in verses 12 and 13. Fifthly, the Bible and the rabbis taught that the Word was the agent of the biblical theophanies, the visible manifestations of God, the visible appearances of God. John agrees. Jesus is a form of the Shekinah glory of God. He is a visible manifestation of God on earth. Number six, the Bible and the rabbis taught that the Word was the agent of the covenants. John agrees in verses 15 through 17 of chapter 1. And finally, the Word is the agent of revelation. And John says as much in John chapter 1, verse 18. So I think you can see that the Bible is much deeper and richer than Greek philosophy. Then I went through an application. I developed the theme, knowledge of the preexistent one. It came from the data that we had studied. The knowledge of the preexistent one came through witnesses, Luke's source, John the Apostle, John the Baptist, and rabbinic theology. And the response to this witness was belief of a few. And the result was they became a child of God. They came to the light. Second response was rejection. Rejection by the world and by the Jew, by the many. The result, the many remained in darkness. And thirdly, the third response was inquiry by Theophilus. And the result, continued study of the life of Yeshua. Then we made a personal application. You've been introduced to Jesus, the Shekinah glory of God who tabernacled among us. What will be your reaction? Belief? Rejection or inquiry? I asked you to write down the word that best describes your response to this lesson, and then I asked you to follow through with a plan of action. How can you make this practical in your life? We moved on then to the cultural importance of genealogies, and I shared with you the genealogy I received from Yosef, a Palestinian Christian who I met. And he stated in his genealogy that he wanted me to get to know him better. And so he had to share his genealogy with me. And that's a Middle Eastern thinking. We get to know who the person is if we know their background and their family. And then we explored the two points of view in the genealogies. Matthew's is from Joseph's perspective, and Luke is from Mary's perspective. Now, the genealogies are often criticized because there's an assumption made that it's only one genealogy, one person's genealogy. And there's no problem prior to the progenitors of Shealtiel. And this begins to show us that these are two separate genealogies, one by Luke and one by Matthew. Because Jeconiah in Matthew's genealogy was Shealtiel's father, and Neri in Luke's genealogy was Shealtiel's father. And then from Zerubbabel on, then there's two common names in the shortest possible sequence. This is also an argument. But the two possible names in the shortest possible sequence is not an argument for sameness, it's an argument for coincidence. And then following Zerubbabel, the list of descendants are all different, arguing for two different lists, two different genealogies, because the lists do not coincide until we come to Joseph. There's no convergence in these lists until Joseph, and his name is highly qualified. Matthew says Joseph was the husband of Mary, by whom, and the word Mary is feminine, by Mary was born Jesus, who was called the Messiah. And Luke says Jesus was being supposedly the son of Joseph. So he points out this is the common misconception. All right, this brings us to the new material. We begin now with the biblical requirements for kingship. We're on Lesson 1, page 20 at the top of the page. The second reason we have two genealogies is because of the biblical requirements for kingship. In the Bible, there were two requirements. One requirement was applicable to the southern kingdom of Judah with its capital in Jerusalem. The other was applicable to the northern kingdom of Israel with its capital in Samaria. And both requirements come into play with Yeshua. So the first requirement is Davidic descent. According to the Davidic covenant, the king had to be of Davidic descent. Now, this was applicable to the southern kingdom of Judah and its capital in Jerusalem. No one could sit upon the throne in Jerusalem unless he was of the Davidic dynasty. Any conspiracy to oust the Davidic family was doomed to failure because of Isaiah chapter 8. An example of such a conspiracy is Isaiah chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. Let's take a look at that. Now, it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. When it was reported to the house of David, saying, "The Arameans have camped in Ephraim," his heart and the hearts of his people shook as trees in the forest shake with the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shaar Yeshuv, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, 'Take care and be calm. Have no fear. Do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands, on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Because Aram and Ephraim, the son of Remaliah, has planned evil against you, saying, "Let us go up against Judah and terrorize it, and make for ourselves a breach in its walls, and set up the king of Tabeel as king in the midst of it." And there's your key phrase. Set up the king of Tabeel as the king in the midst of it. This conspiracy is doomed to failure because they're trying to depose the Davidic line and set up the dynasty of Tabeel. This will not succeed. All right, well, let me summarize the Davidic covenant for you. Now, if you're interested in studying the covenants of the Bible, I would recommend you get Messianic Bible Study number 21, The Eight Covenants of the Bible by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum, available from REL Ministries. You'll get some more details, especially about the Davidic covenant, than I'll be sharing with you here. Okay, the base covenant is the Abrahamic covenant. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is an eternal, unconditional, and unilateral covenant God made with the Jewish people. The Abrahamic covenant consisted of three basic promises: a land promise, a national promise, and a spiritual blessing promise. Now, the three promises of the Abrahamic covenant were expanded and developed by three additional eternal, unconditional, and unilateral covenants God made with the Jewish people. The land promise expanded and developed by the land covenant, the national promise expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant, and the spiritual blessing promise expanded and developed by the new covenant. Now, this is the Davidic covenant that we have in view here. So let's take a look at the Davidic covenant. We will look at the four eternal aspects God promises to David, their explanation and significance. So the first eternal aspect God promised to David is an eternal house, a dynasty. David's family, meaning a succession of kings, will come from David's family. Secondly, God promises David an eternal throne. This is his royal authority. His family will always govern. Thirdly, God promises an eternal kingdom. This is the nation of Israel. And fourth, God promises an eternal person. This is Yeshua, the Messiah. And so you can summarize the four aspects of the Davidic covenant with this sentence: a succession of kings will always govern Israel, culminating with the Messiah. That's the Davidic covenant. All right, we've looked at Davidic descent then. Now let's take a look at divine appointment. The second requirement was applicable to the northern kingdom. It was divine appointment through prophetic sanction. No one can sit on Samaria's throne in the north unless God gave express permission for him to do so through his prophet. And those who usurped the throne without divine sanction were quickly assassinated. For example, the prophet told Jehu, "Your house will sit upon the throne for four generations," and when the fifth man tried to do so, he was assassinated. Now, why would divine appointment be necessary for Yeshua? Well, two reasons. Number one, he'll be king over all united Israel. He'll be king over the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, and so both apply to him. And reason number two, there were many potential claimants for the throne running around in David's day. You had to find out which descendant of David had God chosen. Divine appointment would take care of that. So now we see how both biblical requirements for kingship begin to play a role in the life of the Messiah. So let's start with Matthew's genealogy. Matthew's genealogy is that of Joseph. Now, Matthew breaks Jewish custom by inserting the names of women in the genealogy, and to mention women was forbidden by Jewish tradition. He also skips names. Symmetry is his focus. Symmetry is his idea. Now, the purpose of Matthew's genealogy is to show that Joseph was not Yeshua's father. If Jesus really was Joseph's son, he could not be king. Now, the usual way of explaining the two genealogies is that Luke gives us Christ's real lineage, while Matthew gives us Christ's royal lineage. The statement is made that Joseph was the heir apparent to the throne of David. This is in spite of the fact that there are many descendants of David running around. And because Jesus was his adopted son, he could claim the throne through Joseph. This is not the case. This is a weak position. So let's start with the idea of adoption. There's two reasons why this is a weak position. Let's start with the idea of adoption. Point number one, adoption was not practiced by the Jewish community during the first century or before. Let's take a look at this article in Encyclopedia Judaica on the topic of adoption. Here's what we read. The evidence for adoption in the Bible is so equivocal, vague, that some have denied it was practiced in the biblical period. The evidence for adoption in the pre-exilic period, and of course the biblical period or the pre-exilic period is prior to the Babylonian exile. The evidence for adoption in the pre-exilic period is meager. The possibility that adoption was practiced in this period cannot be excluded, especially since contemporary legal documents are lacking. So we can't deny it, but we can't prove it either. Nevertheless, it seems that if adoption played any role at all in Israelite family institutions, it was an insignificant one. Now, for the post-exilic period in Israel, there is no reliable evidence for adoption at all. Now, the post-exilic period is after the Babylonian exile. And then we move on to later Jewish law. Adoption is not known as a legal institution in Jewish law. According to halakha, that's Jewish law, the personal status of a parent and child is based on the natural family relationship only, and there's no recognized way of creating this status artificially by a legal act or fiction. However, Jewish law does provide for consequences essentially similar to those caused by adoption to be created by legal means. These consequences are the right and obligation of a person to assume responsibility for A, the child's physical and mental welfare, and B, his financial position, including matters of inheritance and maintenance. Okay. The impact of this information is the fact that Joseph could have easily assumed responsibility for Yeshua. Joseph was legally able to provide for Yeshua and to oversee his physical, mental, and financial welfare as his guardian, not as his adopted father. However, that would have not qualified Yeshua for the throne of David through Joseph anyway. Jesus had no claim to the throne if he was Joseph's son. Now why? That's why Matthew starts out with the genealogy. He presents a certain problem and solves the problem with the virgin birth. Now Luke will have no such problem. So he begins immediately with the virgin birth and waits until chapter 3 to give us the genealogy of the Messiah. So now let's take a look at Matthew 1:1. The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So Matthew 1:1 is an introductory verse. This is a summary phrase to connect the early events of Messiah's life with the Jewish covenants. Now, there are four Jewish unconditional, eternal, and unilateral Jewish covenants in the Old Testament. The Abrahamic covenant, the land covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the new covenant. And here we have two of them in view. The son of David, the phrase son of David connects him with the Davidic covenant, and the phrase son of Abraham connects him with the Abrahamic covenant. And of course, these terms, son of David and son of Abraham, are used in the sense of descendant. Matthew is not trying to say that David or Abraham literally conceived Jesus, as some people criticize genealogy for that reason. He's using the term in the sense of descendant, not of the idea of actual conception. Now let's move on to verses 2 and 3. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron and Hezron the father of Ram. So in verse 3, Matthew mentions Tamar, the woman Tamar. Let's move on to verses 4 and 5. Ram was the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nachshon, and Nachshon the father of Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahav, Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse. So in verse 5, Matthew mentions Rahab, and in verse 5, Matthew mentions Ruth, two more women. Verse 6, Jesse was the father of David the king, David was the father of Solomon, by her who had been the wife of Uriah, literally by her of Uriah. And so in verse 6, Bathsheba, another woman, is referred to indirectly. So four women are referred to, and three, possibly all four of these women, are Gentiles. Ruth is a Moabitess, Tamar is a Canaanitess, Rahab is from Canaan, Canaanitess, and Bathsheba. Now she's the only candidate that would qualify for being Jewish, and we're not sure that she was. So at least three of them were Gentiles. So Matthew is already pointing out that although Jesus was the king of the Jews who came primarily for the Jews, the Gentiles would also benefit. Now, three of these four women were guilty of sexual sin. Rahab was a prostitute, Tamar was guilty of incest, Bathsheba was guilty of adultery. Now, the point of including these three sinners in Messiah's genealogy is to stress that Jesus came to save sinners. Now, these ladies are all pre-Davidic ancestors of David. Excuse me. These ladies are all pre-Davidic ancestors of Jesus. But these two points developed by breaking tradition is not the main point of the genealogy. No problems exist prior to David's name. So let's continue on and look at the two genealogies. We'll put Luke's genealogy on the left side and Matthew's genealogy on the right side. Now Matthew traces Joseph's genealogy beginning in verse 2 with Abraham and continues down to verse 6 with David. And we've read those first six verses. Then Matthew chooses one of David's sons, Solomon. From Solomon, Matthew traces Joseph's genealogy down to verse 11 and a man called Jeconiah. And then he continues down to verse 16 and Joseph. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah. So remember, in verse 16, Matthew tells us that Joseph was the husband of Mary, by whom was born Jesus. Remember, those words by whom are feminine. They refer to Mary, not to Joseph. He is saying that Jesus was born of Mary, not of Joseph. So here we have down to Joseph. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called Messiah. Now, if we chart this out, on the left side, we have all the masculine, all the men that are in the genealogy. And so the masculine gender is used the whole time. I'm just using Jacob and Joseph as examples. But then we have to switch to the feminine gender to talk about Mary. And so the word by whom was born Jesus, who is called Messiah, is feminine. It refers to Mary. And so Jesus is not a direct descendant of Joseph. In the right column, he is a direct descendant of Mary. He's a direct descendant of Mary, but not of Joseph. So we're told that Joseph is also a direct descendant of Jeconiah. And this is a crucial issue. And we'll see this in Jeremiah 22, 24 through 30. As I live, declares the Lord, even though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were a signet ring on my right hand, yet I would pull you off, and I will give you over to the hand of those who are seeking your life. Yes, into the hand of those whom you dread. Even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. I will hurl you and your mother who bore you into another country where you were not born, and there you will die. But as for the land to which they desire to return, they will not return to it. Is this man Coniah a despised, shattered jar? Or is he an undesirable vessel? Why have he and his descendants been hurled out and cast to a land that they have not known? Why has that happened? Here's the answer. O land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. Now, Coniah is a variant form of Jeconiah, kind of like Robert is the primary form of my name, and Bob and Bobby are variants in English. We're talking about the same individual, even though the name is a different form. And because of the kind of man that Jeconiah was, Jeremiah pronounces a curse upon him, and you can see the curse on the screen. The curse consists of the fact that no descendant of Jeconiah will ever have the right to sit on the throne. Now, we are told that by Matthew, that Joseph is a direct descendant of Jeconiah, and that's a problem. So he was not the heir apparent to the throne. Joseph was not the heir apparent. If Jesus really was Joseph's son, he could not be king. If he was counted as Joseph's son, he fell under the Jeconiah curse and could not be king. That's why Matthew starts with the genealogy. He solves the problem with the account of the virgin birth. The virgin birth tells us that Jesus was not born of Joseph. Now, Joseph looked after his welfare, but he was not Yeshua's father. So initially, the Bible required kingship, a descendant of David. But in Jeremiah's day, it was narrowed to a member of the house of David, but apart from Jeconiah. So Matthew is saying that Jesus has no association with Jeconiah. Jesus is not part of Jeconiah's line in any way, shape, or form. Jesus does not fall under the Jeconiah curse. Okay, let's take a look at Matthew 1:17. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. So Matthew gives us instructions how to interpret his 14 generations in verse 17. Between keywords, we find 14 names. A possible reason why Matthew chose the number 14 lies in the fact that the numerical value of David in Hebrew equals 14. Every Hebrew letter has a numerical value assigned to it. So here's the name David, Dalet, Vav, Dalet. Dalet has the number 4, Vav is the number 6, and Dalet is the number 4. 4 plus 6 plus 4 equals 14. So that's one reason why he has 14 generations. Well, let's look at the generations. The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Perez, Hezron, Ram, Aminadab, Nachshon, Salmon, Boaz, Obed, Jesse. Jesse was the father of David the king. So between those two names, two key names, 14 generations, Abraham to David. We pick it up. David was the father of Solomon, Rehoboam, Abiah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Yoram, Uzziah, Yotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Amon, Josiah, Jeconiah, at the time of the deportation to Babylon. So from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. We move on. After the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah, Shealtiel, Zerubbabel, Abihud, Eliakim, Azor, Zadok, Achim, Elihud, Elazar, Matan, Jacob, Joseph, Jesus, who is called Messiah. So from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. Symmetry. Symmetry is Matthew's focus. 14, 14, 14. So let me kind of summarize Matthew's genealogy. Matthew is presenting Yeshua's genealogy in relation to his guardian, Joseph. Joseph is an honorable man with a fine heritage. He's a good man of high moral character. He was a direct descendant of King David through David's son Solomon. However, Joseph was not Yeshua's father, verse 16. He is Mary's husband and Yeshua's guardian, and that's why he's important. He was given a great privilege and responsibility, but Joseph is not the heir apparent to the throne of David. He is not the heir apparent because of the Jeconiah curse. Joseph had no legal right to sit on David's throne. If Yeshua had been his son, naturally or by adoption, then Yeshua would have been disqualified from the messianic office by the Jeconiah curse. Now, by presenting the genealogy in the stylistic form of three sets of 14, Matthew is stating, my rendering of Joseph's lineage is true and accurate and sacred account. It's harmonious. It's orderly. It's true. It's made up of sevens and threes. It reveals the truth that Joseph was not Yeshua's father. Joseph was the husband of Yeshua's mother and the guardian of the Messiah, and that's all. He was not Yeshua's natural father. He was not Yeshua's stepfather. He was not Yeshua's adopted father. He bore the honor of being Messiah's guardian. And that's as far as it went. The important result of all this is the fact that Yeshua is not disqualified by the Jeconiah curse. The Jeconiah curse does not concern Yeshua. It concerns Joseph, but not Yeshua. All right. Time to move on to Luke's genealogy. Now, Luke follows strict Jewish law. He mentions no women, not even Mary, although it is her line that he is tracing. He skips no names. Symmetry is not his focus. His focus is historical accuracy. He shows us that Jesus could still be king because Jesus was a descendant of David, but apart from the house of Jeconiah. He has no problem with Jeconiah. That's why he begins his gospel differently. Only later does he deal with the genealogy to show that Jesus did descend from David. All right, let's pick it up at Luke chapter 3, verses 23 and 24. When he began his ministry, Jesus himself was about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Eli, the son of Matthat, the son of Levi, the son of Malki, the son of Yannai. Now, in Luke's list of names, all the names have the Greek definite article with the exception of the name Joseph. No definite article with Joseph. It's Joseph, but it's the Eli, the Matthat, the Levi, the Malki. The word the is the definite article. And that's what the name Joseph is missing. Luke is deliberately using this literary device to set off the name Joseph, to set it apart. What that tells us is that a better way of translating the verse is to put a parenthesis around the phrase at the end of Joseph there. A better way of reading this is, being the son as was supposed, King James Version, being the son as was thought, the NIV, being the son, being supposedly the son, the NASB, of Joseph. All those translations agree that this is the better way to render it. This is the popular misunderstanding. The misunderstanding of the time was that Jesus was the son of Joseph. Now highlight this thought in your mind. Mark it with a fluorescent yellow mental marker. This is the key issue that affects Matthew and Luke's genealogy. Everybody thought that Joseph was Yeshua's father. That was the current popular misconception. They thought he had a human, natural father like everyone else. They didn't think Yeshua was adopted. Adoption was not practiced in the first century Israel. They thought that Joseph was his father. That would disqualify him from the throne. If Yeshua could not be Israel's king, then he could not be Israel's Messiah. Matthew has just shown that Joseph is not Yeshua's father. Now that would raise the question, then, who is his father? Matthew will answer that question with the virgin birth. God is Yeshua's father. But now another question would be raised. If Joseph is not his father, does Yeshua have a legitimate link to the Davidic throne? Luke is going to answer that question affirmatively. Yes, Yeshua does possess a legitimate link to the Davidic throne. So let's see how Luke proves this. Jesus was the descendant of Eli, or he was rather the grandson of Eli. Let's take a close look at that section of the genealogy. We'll take out the parentheses, Jesus being the son of Eli. Now let's take a look at this. Jesus being the son of Eli, who was Eli, Eli is Mary's father. It is possible in Jewish writings of the first and second century, that Jesus is referred to by the rabbis as the son of Eli. For example, John Lightfoot thinks so in his commentary on the New Testament and Hebraica from the Jerusalem Talmud. There is a discourse of a certain person who in his sleep saw the punishment of the damned. He saw Mary, the daughter of Heli, or Eli. It's just a variant form, variant spelling of the name. He saw Mary, the daughter of Eli, among the shades. Rabbi Joseph Bar Hanina saith that the great bar of hell's gate hung at her ear. So here we have a Mary, daughter of Eli, or Eli, who is damned and being extremely punished. Could this be Mary, the mother of Jesus? Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum of Ariel Ministries thinks this is the case. Others disagree. R. Travers Herford, in his book Christianity and the Talmud and Midrash, thinks it's unlikely. But I'm with Dr. Fruchtenbaum because I know of no other Mary, daughter of Heli or Eli, who would be so reviled. The only Mary that I know that's a daughter of Heli that would be so reviled is Mary, the mother of Jesus. Now, it's not unique in Jewish systems to trace a man's origin through his wife. We have an example in the Bible Ezra 2:61 and Nehemiah 7:63. Of the priests, the sons of Hobiah, the sons of Akkoz, the sons of Barzillai, who took a wife of the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and was named after them. Well, here a man's origin was traced not through his real line, but through his wife's line. His line was traced through the daughters of Barzillai. Now, this is because of strict Jewish law forbidding the mention of women's names in genealogies. Remember, Luke is following strict Jewish practice in the way he presents Messiah's genealogy. He cannot mention Mary's name, so he mentions Joseph's name. And to show that he doesn't really mean Joseph, but Joseph's wife, he excludes the Greek definite article from Joseph's name and includes it with all the others. So he's tracing Mary's line, not Joseph's. This is also in keeping with the style of his entire gospel, which tells the story from Mary's perspective, not Joseph's. Now, Luke traces the genealogy in reverse order than Matthew. Luke starts in the past and comes down to the present. But Luke starts in his own time and traces backward in time, from his own time back to the past. And he goes all the way back to God. And he's going to use God as a bookend at each end of his genealogy, at the beginning of the genealogy and also at the end. Now, as we come to verse 31, we come to Nathan and David. Luke chapter 3, verse 31. The son of Mele, the son of Manah, the son of Mattathah, the son of Nathan, Nathan, the son of David. Now, Luke also traces the genealogy back to David. However, David had another son, Nathan. So let's add in Nathan. There we go. David's line through Solomon ended with Jeconiah and the curse. This factor excluded Joseph and his descendants from sitting on David's throne. And the reason that this occurred lies with this principle. Here's the principle. The Davidic covenant is unconditional for David, but is conditional for Solomon. The Davidic covenant will be fulfilled for David without question. However, the descendant through whom it will be fulfilled is conditional upon the obedience of that descendant and his line. Excuse me. Now, key statements that are usually not mentioned are 1 Chronicles 22, 6 through 13, and 1 Chronicles 28, 7. In 1 Chronicles 22, 13, we see David's understanding of the Davidic covenant. David is reviewing the promise God made to him and charging Solomon to build the temple in verses 6 through 12. In verse 13, David says to Solomon, "Then you will prosper if you are careful to observe the statutes and the ordinances which the Lord commanded Moses concerning Israel. Be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be dismayed." His statement to Solomon is conditional. Then you will prosper if you follow through. Now we need to ask ourselves, did Solomon personally obey the law carefully? And the answer comes in 1 Kings 11:9. Now the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. So Solomon failed to diligently follow the Lord and was disciplined. Now in 1 Chronicles 28, David is again explaining his understanding of the Davidic covenant. His crucial statement is found in verse 7. David is quoting God. God says, "I, God, I will establish his kingdom," speaking of Solomon's kingdom, "forever if he resolutely performs my commandments and my ordinances as is done now." And note the conditional element concerning Solomon. "I will establish if." So it appears to me that David understands the Davidic covenant to be conditional in regard to Solomon. Now, did Solomon resolutely perform the Mosaic law? No. 1 Kings 11:9, we already took a look at that. However, in 1 Kings 9:3, we have God's promise and warning personally to Solomon. This is lesson number 1, page 25 in the middle of the page. Here are verses 4 through 7 with my emphasis added. God is talking to Solomon. "As for you, if you, Solomon, If you will walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I command you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, just as I promised to your father David, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you or your sons indeed turn away from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them. And the house which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. In other words, diaspora and destruction. And so Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And finally, one more verse, one more section I want to look at is Psalm 89, 28 through 37. My loving kindness I will keep for him, referring to David, forever. And my covenant shall be confirmed to him. So I will establish, his descendants forever and his throne as the days of heaven. If his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will punish their transgression with a rod and their iniquity with stripes. But I will not break my loving kindness from him, David, nor deal falsely in my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. Once I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His descendants shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon, and the witness in the sky is faithful. Selah. So notice God's assessment of the Davidic covenant. Please let me summarize. God will fulfill his promise to David of an eternal house, throne, person, and kingdom, but it will only come through Solomon's line if Solomon's line is worthy. Solomon's line was not worthy and was cut off conclusively with the Jeconiah curse. A transfer of the covenant promise to another descendant of David is required. This is where Luke's genealogy comes into play. So we already know that Solomon failed to follow the Mosaic covenant properly. But did any other of his sons fail as well? Well, a number of them failed to follow the Mosaic covenant. Now, following Solomon, there were 20 kings of Judah. Now, there's a chart I'd like to refer to on page 26 of Lesson 1, called the Kings of Judah. The middle column there is labeled character, and you can look down the column and you can see that a number of the kings were bad and a number of the kings were good. But Solomon's line was disqualified and disciplined because 12 of those kings were bad kings, the majority. Only 8 were godly. Now Jeconiah, the 13th king, was one of the worst. He was so bad that God pronounced the Jeconiah curse on him. Now his successor, Zedekiah, did not prosper under Babylonian domination. Eventually he revolted, he was defeated, and Babylon destroyed the city and the temple. So from 1 Kings 9, I would say once again that the Davidic covenant is unconditional in regard to David. It cannot be revoked, it will be fulfilled. However, it is conditional concerning Solomon and his descendants. And this is important enough to repeat. God will fulfill his promise to David of an eternal house, throne, person, and kingdom, but it will only come through Solomon's line if Solomon's line is worthy. Solomon's line was not worthy and was cut off conclusively with the Jeconiah curse. A transfer of the covenant promise to another descendant of David is required. And this is where Luke's genealogy comes into play. He tells us that the transfer was made to another son of David. Well, which one? He had over 20 sons. Here's his family tree. At the top there, you can see all of his wives. He had a bunch of wives, but below that black line is David's sons. He had over 20 sons. This chart is on page 27 of lesson number 1. Now, Jesus was a descendant of David, from a different son, from Nathan. Now, Solomon, interestingly enough, Solomon and Nathan had the same mother. There's Bathsheba. And there's Nathan and Solomon. They had the same mother. And so Bathsheba gave birth to Solomon, the firstborn. But Solomon did not follow the Mosaic law carefully throughout his life, and he was disqualified. The transfer was then made to Nathan. And consequently, there's no blood of Jeconiah in the veins of Jesus. There's the transfers made over to Nathan's line. Jesus was a member of the house of David apart from Jeconiah, so he could be king. Transfer was made to Jeconiah's line. He could be king through Mary, through Eli, through Nathan. Now, a lot of people think this is kind of a radically different position. And let me confirm my radically different position by referring to Zechariah 12, 10 through 12. I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication, so they will look on me whom they have pierced. This is the second coming. And they will mourn for him, as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him, like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. In that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadad-Rimon in the plain of Megiddo. The land will mourn, every family by itself. Now notice who's mourning. The family of the house of David by itself, and their wives by themselves. That's logical, because Jesus comes from the Davidic dynasty. And the family of the house of Nathan by itself, and their wives by themselves. And that's consistent, because Jesus is a descendant of Nathan, the house of Nathan. So the house of Nathan are the prominent descendants of David at the second coming. Notice that. The house of Nathan is the house that's prominent at the second coming, not the house of Solomon. You would think that if the Messiah comes through Solomon's line, then Solomon's line would be preserved, not Nathan's. But Solomon's line was disqualified. And this means that there are descendants of David through the house of Nathan alive today. And that means that Luke's genealogy is the real and royal line. Let me summarize this. Jesus was not the only descendant of David at that time. There were many potential Davidic claimants to the throne in the first century. In fact, long after the time of Jesus, in 70 AD, Vespasian hunted down and executed the house of David. He tried to root out the entire royal line because many claimants to the throne were still around. Vespasian was not interested in allowing a Davidic descendant to be proclaimed king. And we learn this from Schurer and Eusebius. Here is a history of the Jewish people at the time of Jesus Christ by Emil Schurer. We read, Vespasian, as well as Domitian and Trajan, is said by Hegesippus to have hunted for and executed all Jews of the house of David with great rigor, in order that the royal family in which the Jews rested their hopes should be rooted out. Lots of descendants of David running around. That a Messiah descending from the house of David was expected is beyond dispute. The existence, therefore, of descendants of David might actually be looked upon as a source of political danger. You better believe it. And then Eusebius Pamphilius in Ecclesiastical History concurs. It was also said that Vespasian, after the capture of Jerusalem, commanded all the family of David to be sought, that no one might be left among the Jews who were of the royal stock, and that in consequence, another very, very violent persecution was raised against the Jews. So there were many, many descendants of David running around at this time. The important thing to note right now is that Luke gives us Messiah's genealogy, showing that Jesus was of the house of David apart from Jeconiah, and therefore he had a legitimate claim to the throne. Finally, the royal credentials of Jesus were impeccable. If they were not impeccable, he would have been easily dismissed as an obvious imposter by the religious leaders. So Luke's genealogy is both the real and the royal genealogy of Yeshua. But this does not solve the entire problem of Luke's genealogy. Why? Well, because claimants continued to emerge. Even later, in 135 AD, the leader of the second Jewish revolt, Bar Kokhba, is said to be of Davidic descent. Vespasian apparently missed killing his parents. And even down to 1992 AD, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson claimed Davidic descent. That's why his followers called for him to declare himself to be the Messiah. He never did declare himself that he'd be the Messiah, but some sure thought he was. So at this point in Jewish history, the first century, there were a number of legitimate descendants of David on the scene. Of these other heirs to the throne, why was Jesus chosen above the others? And this is where that element of divine appointment comes in. Remember, there are two requirements for kingship: Davidic descent, divine appointment. And when Yeshua is conceived, the angel tells Mary that it is her child and none other who is appointed to David's throne. Luke chapter 1, verses 30 through 33. The angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall name him Yeshua. And he will be great, and he will be what? He will be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give him what? The throne of his father David. And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. And his kingdom will have no end." There's your Davidic covenant there, right? There's your Davidic covenant. Well, four titles are given to Jesus in these two genealogies. And these titles present his four basic states: Son of David, Son of Abraham in Matthew 1:1, and then in Luke 3:38, the Son of Adam and the Son of God. Remember our messianic diagram of earlier? The Son of David shows him to be the king. The Son of Abraham shows that Jesus was a Jew. The Son of Adam shows that Jesus was a man. The Son of God shows that Jesus was God. So these titles picture and portray the Jewish God-man king. Now, let me close the section with an amazing Jewish tradition. This tradition states that the Messiah will have no father. I found it in the Suffering Servant of Isaiah, according to the Jewish interpreters, page 33. There we read. We reread from the Bereshit Rabbah of Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. There we read, says Rav Berakiah, "The Holy One said to Israel, 'You've spoken before me, saying, we are orphans and have no father.'" So apparently, he feels that Israel's been complaining to God. "We're orphans, we have no father." And then God gives them an answer to their dilemma. "The Redeemer whom I shall raise up out of your midst will have no father also." So he claims that the Messiah will have no father. And then he goes on to prove his assertion by quoting two messianic prophecies. As it is said, "Behold the man whose name is the branch, and he shall branch up out of his place." Zechariah 6:12, messianic prophecy. And similarly by Isaiah, "He came up as a sucker before him." I guess he feels that the vegetation motif here, coming up as a branch and coming up as a sucker out of the tree, also supports the idea that the Messiah will not have a human father. Well, my point is this: Yeshua had no earthly father. I would agree with the rabbi. The Messiah has no earthly father. His father is God. And this is fully in accord with Isaiah 7:14, which is the virgin birth. Yeshua had no human father. And it's fully in accord with the New Testament genealogies as well, that teach us that God is his father not Joseph. All right, well, I am down to 5 minutes remaining, and so I know I have a lot of material coming up. So this is a good place to quit. I will, I'll give you a little extra time here. You can go get out of class early today. Next session will be in part two, the early years of John the Baptist. That'll be lesson number one, page 29 at the top. So we'll pick it up then. We'll pick it up in the next session. Thanks so much for being our students. We hope and trust that these lessons in the Jewish life of the Messiah will be a blessing to your soul and an encouragement to your walk.